I'm going to call the meeting to order. A quorum is present. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from February 21st, 2024. Representative Kraft, would you like to make a motion?
I will move their approval, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kraft moves approval of the minutes from February 21st, 2024. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda today is House File 3326. There, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, as she comes down, I will move House File 3326 be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. And Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you have the A24 amendment. I assume this gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it?
Yes, please.
All right, so I will move the A24 amendment. Any discussion to the A24? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. A24 is adopted. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager here. Thank you so much for taking the time to take a look at this bill and have a good discussion about it. This basically will phase out the sale of mercury-containing light bulbs. Mercury is a well-known toxin. It's a heavy metal, just like lead, and it's really dangerous, especially for pregnant people and kids. Minnesota has a history of taking mercury very seriously. In 1993, we were the first to enact a mercury lamp disposal ban and requiring recycling of all mercury-containing lamps. And then in 2007, we became the first state to ban mercury in cosmetics and skin lightening creams. So now the next step is to make sure that our homes, our businesses, and other places are safe from mercury. Many stores still sell these really fragile bulbs of toxic mercury vapor that are just waiting to break, mostly in fluorescent bulbs or called lamps throughout the bill. This bill works to phase out the sale of these types of bulbs. So as your bulbs burn out, when you go to the store, you can basically just replace it with a non-mercury vapor-containing bulb. And what's really exciting is that we already have cost-comparable, more efficient alternatives available, LED lights. So this is really great for consumers and businesses because we have them all LED alternatives readily available. They're more cost-effective, they last longer, and they're already providing mercury-free light in our homes, schools, houses of worship, and places of work. The bill does recognize that there are some specialty applications like photocopying, film and video production, and when it's needed for germicidal use, and those are exempted in the language as well. It's been really great to work with a diverse group of stakeholders on this policy. Waste haulers are supportive because they don't want to be exposed to mercury vapor when the bulbs break because they're put in the trash can by mistake. Environmental groups want to protect our air and water. Energy advocates want more efficient lighting to address climate change. And our consumer advocates are all motivated by this too. The fiscal note shows that the costs can be absorbed by the agency, which is also great. And I look forward to having our two testifiers describe this a little bit more and to our discussion. So thank you.
All right. I think we have a couple testifiers here. First, Eric Fowler. Is that right? Or are you Josh McClenney?
Yes.
All right. Mr. McClenney, if you could state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. My name is Josh McClenney. I work for the Appliance Standards Awareness Project. I'm here to speak in support of HF 3326 and reinforce that LED technology is affordable, reliable, and ready to go. ASAP published a report in 2022 evaluating the lighting market, asking that very question, are LEDs ready? We found that the answer is yes. They are now widely available and cost-effective as alternatives to fluorescents. We found that LEDs are twice as energy efficient, which generates significant utility bill savings. We found they last 2 to 3 times as long as fluorescents. And of course, they don't contain mercury by design. Not only did we find that LEDs were ready to go operationally, but they're widely available. LEDs are designed to be drop-in replacements for fluorescents, so in most cases, you can just take out the fluorescent and pop in an LED. We found that LEDs are better for folks' back pockets. They've come down in price dramatically over the last 10 years. And statewide, ASAP calculates that by 2050, Minnesota could see about $947 million in utility bill savings from transitioning to LEDs. The most common fluorescent light bulb type is the 4-foot T8. We found that the LED replacement on average costs just 11 cents more. that 11 cents is recovered in just a couple of weeks through utility bill savings. Since 2022, seven different states have passed nearly identical policies, phasing out the sale of common fluorescent light bulbs because of the findings that LEDs are ready to go. I hope Minnesota will join them. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we'll hear from Eric Fowler. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much to the chair and to the committee. My name is Eric Fowler. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm a senior policy associate on Fresh Energy's buildings team. Fresh Energy is a nonpartisan Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit dedicated to advancing the clean energy economy. And I'm grateful to testify in support of HF 3326, which will make lighting safer and more efficient. So fluorescent lights at this point are unnecessarily dangerous and wasteful. We've heard there is no such thing as a mercury-free fluorescent light, and the LED alternatives are mercury-free and use, as we heard, half the energy, saving consumers and businesses on their electric bills and cutting a significant amount of carbon emissions, and critically, reducing peak lighting demand on the electric grid. Some of those savings look like, in a single year, the report that my colleague just described by the Appliance Standards Awareness Project estimated a potential electricity savings in 1 year of 681 gigawatt hours, which could equate to $72 million in utility cost savings. So we really see this as having multiple benefits. We heard that this has passed in other states. Those states include Vermont, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Maine. And I will. I hope that we will move this forward in Minnesota as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am old enough to remember when Democrats were mandating the use of fluorescent light bulbs, and so I'm wondering if this is going to run into conflict with any federal regulations.
Representative Hemingson-Yeager.
Great. Thank you. Good question. Not to my awareness. I might defer just to double check with Mr. Fowler or Mr. McClenny.
Looks like Mr. McClenny is coming forward. Mr. McClenny, I don't know if you can answer that question.
There's currently no federal regulation that limits fluorescent lighting based on its mercury content. There's a proposed rule from the Department of Energy that would set a lumen per watt limit for all light bulbs, but that would only apply to compact fluorescents, which make up just about 10% of what we're talking about, 10% of what generates the savings. Linear fluorescents, which most of the savings come from, would not be covered by that proposed rule. It's not finalized yet.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, Representative Hemingson-Yeager. What is the status of these light bulbs in the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin that border the state of Minnesota? Do they have similar bans or proposed bans like you're advocating for today in your bill?
Representative Hemingson-Yeager.
Oh, another good question. I have not looked into it. I can look at my testifiers if they know. Otherwise, I can look into it.
Mr. McClenny.
None of those states have phased out the sale of fluorescents, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And follow-up question. So if Minnesota bans the use of these products, what is the penalty for a person or a party that would purchase them in Wisconsin and bring them to Minnesota for use?
Representative Hemingson-Yeager.
So this bill, thank you, this bill limits it to the sale of these within Minnesota, which the Pollution Control Agency regularly checks the compliance of the sellers of this. This is not something where we would be going into people's houses and checking their light bulbs. This is something where it actually happened in my own home. We were looking to get rid of the fluorescent light bulbs in our kitchen, and my husband went out to, I think, Home Depot or another big box store, and they were the same price for LED, popped them out, popped them in, and it was really, really simple.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, just a follow-up. I realize that the use is one thing and the sale is another on this. I just want to make sure that if for whatever individual preference happens to be or someone purchased them, that you didn't quite say it this way, but that the light bulb police aren't coming to check to make sure that they didn't purchase or using a product that would otherwise be banned under this particular provision when the property owner or owner of that bulb and light system is using the system inadvertently or in a foul of what you're trying to accomplish here.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
I will try my best. That was a long question, but correct. These would basically just phase out the availability of these mercury-containing bulbs on the shelves. If a person wanted to purchase them from a neighboring state, nothing in this bill is prohibiting that. But what is exciting is that we already have healthier, safer, more cost-effective bulbs at the same price. So.
Any closing comments? Oh, sorry, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the representative. I think it kind of follows what was just said, but I think that we should be careful around the terms ban, because ban could insinuate that we are potentially going after those who are currently using these. I don't think that this is your intention from what I've heard so far from your comments. I just think that the language could definitely be brought to a place where we have a little bit more clarity, because frankly, when I was door knocking back home in the last week, I heard from folks saying, well, if we're going to change light bulbs in this state, that it shouldn't be, we shouldn't be passing legislation that demands that they be changed upon the moment, but instead driven by the market and driven by their next purchase of light bulbs. So I just wanted to just kind of make that comment and just see if we could maybe bring some clarity to your language, given that right on line 1.7, it begins with ban, and I think that could make this unclear for the public.
All right. Now closing comments from Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for the discussion. Like I said, this is really exciting for me because I think with the natural phase out, as people are looking to do home improvements or just their bulbs are burning out, they have something that, again, is cost comparable, better for the environment, better for the health, better for cost effectiveness, that they can pop in, pop out. There are two handouts in your packets I just want to draw your attention to, one on the cost savings, one a little bit more on bulbs themselves. And just would really appreciate a passage today. So thank you for your time and attention.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 3326 as amended be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 3326, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is House File 3577 from Representative Jordan. I will move House File 3577 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. The A2 amendment, I believe, is an author's amendment getting the bill in the shape that the committee should consider it. Is that correct, Representative Jordan?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will move the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, could you walk us through the changes that your amendment will bring to the bill?
Representative Jordan.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment amends the definition of a producer. This comes from producers and mirrors other states. There is also some language that was brought to me by the League of Cities to protect existing contracts with cities and haulers. It ensures existing contract law is not changed under organized collection. It also outlines an exemption process brought by the MPCA, and it exempts infant formula and nutritional food. And I do ask for member support to help improve the bill.
Any follow-up for Representative Schultz? Nope. Okay. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and A2 is adopted. Representative Jordan, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, Minnesota has a waste problem, and 40% of our waste comes from packaging. We could fill 10 target fields with the packaging waste that is put in landfills and incinerators in Minnesota every year. And this will continue to grow as we have more and more of an e-commerce economy, and we are receiving more goods that are being shipped to us. Currently, we, as taxpayers, are responsible for the cost of a product's end life as we pay taxes to local government and fees to deal with our waste. Much of what could be recycled is put into a landfill or burned in incinerators. This is a public health concern. toxics, microplastic, asthma, and other upper respiratory diseases from incineration. We see runoff from our waste into our soil and water in our landfills. The average American consumes a credit card worth of plastic each week in the air that we breathe and the food that we eat. Microplastics have been found in breast milk, blood, and placenta. And as we create new plastics and transport that waste to end markets, it exacerbates climate change. So to solve this problem, we must both generate less waste and deal with what waste we reduce more and deal with what waste we produce more effectively. And this bill does both. It outlines goals on page 23 of your first engrossment. And the idea behind this bill is that the producers of this waste pay for it. They are held accountable by the MPCA, but they pay for this waste themselves and also serve on a PRO, or producer responsibility organization, that governs how that waste is dealt with and provides solutions to dealing with our waste problem. Members, this is a good consumer bill. There are cost savings to taxpayers in our local government. There's investments in Minnesota manufacturing. We have small businesses that invest in reuse being supported with this bill, and we have numerous investments in public health and prevention. And so, members, rather than walking through the bill section by section, I'm instead going to go through a timeline of how the bill is implemented and what that would mean for Minnesotans. So, the first part of this bill that would go into effect, should it be signed into law, would start on January 1st of 2025. This would establish the PRO, which again stands for Producer Responsibility Organization. From now on, I'm just going to call it a PRO. It establishes an advisory board. Membership would be listed starting on page 9. And then brands would register with the PRO and would do this annually. On March 1st, the advisory board would have its first meeting, or before. On October 1st of next year, the commissioner would notify brands of their fee to administer the advisory board. This would be annual until the first stewardship plan created by the advisory board is enacted. And brands have 45 days to remit their payment. Details for that fee start on line 25.7. On December 31st of 2026, our first needs assessment of this bill would be completed. The needs assessment is outlined starting on 15.17. The needs assessment is updated every 5 years and is the baseline for determining when we have met our recycling goals. Some highlights for the needs assessment include our current reuse, recycling, and compost rates aggregated by material, performance targets to meet our reduce goals, assessment of our current infrastructure goals and future needs for infrastructure, an assessment of end markets in Minnesota for recycled goods, reports on toxics in waste and recycled goods, and public education needs to make sure we as Minnesotans, businesses, and producers in our state have what we need to be educated about how to recycle and reduce our waste. So then by March 1st of 2027, the MPCA will provide a list of covered materials that are considered recyclable or compostable. This repeats every 3 years. A year later, the PRO will submit its first operation or stewardship plan as determined by the needs assessment. That plan will be redone every 5 years. There will be an amendment process by the brands, and that will need to be addressed by the advisory board. And the content of stewardship plan starts on lines 18.28. Some highlights for folks are the performance targets aggregated by material, glass, plastic, aluminum, et cetera. Collection methods, details on how the PRO is measuring content, producer fees, investment proposals, and a report on responsible end markets. On October 1st of that year, the PRO will notify registered producers of their responsibilities and their fee for the following year to be able to run the PRO and recycle the waste. On January 1st of 2029, producers must register with the PRO to do business in Minnesota. By July 1st of 2031, the first PRO report will be submitted to the MPCA and then will be submitted annually afterwards. And then by January 1st of 2032, all packaging in Minnesota must be reusable, recyclable, or compostable. There is extensive testimony in your packets. I hope members can take a look at that. Make sure make yourself a snack and sit down and get through it. And I think with that, we can go on to testimony from here in the room, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. We do have a number of people who signed up to testify on this bill, and we also have a number of people who signed up to testify on the next bill. Given in our limited time frame, I'm asking all testifiers to limit their testimony to 2 minutes. If you get much beyond 2 minutes, you will expect to hear from me about it. So please, please, please help us accommodate everybody who wants to testify today. The first test, and I'm going to kind of give two names each time here. So if you're on deck, move towards the front so you can slide right in and go. Our first testifier is Commissioner Victoria Reinhart, who will be followed by Lucy Milani. Excuse me. Commissioner Reinhart, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I serve as chair of the Partnership on Waste and Energy, which is a collaboration of Ramsey, Hennepin, and Washington counties. I want to thank Representative Jordan for her leadership in carrying this bill, and I thank you, Chair Stevenson, for scheduling this hearing. I am pleased to be here today to talk to you about why House File 3577, the Packaging Waste and Cost Reduction Act, is so important to counties. Counties are accountable by state under state law for assuring responsible management of waste. We are working very hard with our cities, recyclers, residents, and businesses to keep as much waste out of landfills as possible. Counties spend 4 to 5 times more on recycling efforts than we receive in state funding through SCORE grants. Cities raise tens of millions of dollars annually in taxes and fees to operate their recycling programs. Even though Minnesota's recycling system is one of the best in the country, our recycling rates have been stuck at around 40% for a decade. State law sets a recycling mandate for metro counties of 75% by 2030. Resources that could be recycled or composted to support jobs and our economy are instead creating mountains of trash in our landfills. We need to get the state out of the business as usual and get us to the next level to meet state recycling mandates and our zero waste ambitions. The Packaging Waste and Cost Reduction Act holds packaging and paper product producers accountable to fix the problem they've created and close the gaps where we are losing recyclables now. Producers are being called to bring solutions to help reach our environmental goals, building on the state's existing recycling infrastructure with producers, not taxpayers, paying the cost of recycling, significantly reducing the financial burden on counties and cities and taxpayers. These are just a few of the many reasons this act is so important to counties. I respectfully ask that the committee approve House File 3577 and put Minnesota on a path to greater success in waste reduction, reuse, recycling, and composting. Again, thank you, Chair Stevenson and members, for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or at the end, whichever you prefer.
Thank you much. Our next testifier is Lucy Milani, who will be followed by Kirk Kudelka. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, and Rep. Jordan for her leadership on this issue. I'm Lucy Milani. I'm Director of Policy and Advocacy with Eureka Recycling. Eureka is one of the largest recyclers in the state. We're a proud union shop with union mechanics and union drivers. Our team sorts 100,000 tons of residential recyclables every year into 15 different commodities that support our local supply chain. About 75% of our feedstock is turned into new products by manufacturers here in Minnesota and 95% in the upper Midwest. We work to demonstrate that recycling can and should be done in ways that benefit our economy and communities. Unfortunately, the growing packaging crisis is making our work incredibly difficult. Problematic and unnecessary packaging is trashing our recycling system, adding contamination and unnecessary costs to communities and businesses. The bill holds producers responsible for these impacts and drives them towards much needed change. The bill supports quality jobs and local businesses. We've worked really closely with the author to ensure it protects the open and fair bidding process that haulers across our state are currently accustomed to and ensures that priority is given to service providers here in Minnesota that provide good jobs, strong safety standards, and quality services. The bill also strengthens Minnesota's economy through minimum recycled content requirements that provide much needed stability to our commodity markets here in Minnesota. And the bill removes the financial burden of recycling from families and local governments. Recycling in Minnesota has stagnated for over a decade, and the truth is it's plagued by volatile commodity markets, increasing contamination rates, limited local government resources, inequities in services, and it's a patchwork system of programs. This bill transforms the packaging stream and improves how we fund and support the entire system. We've provided additional details in our written testimony and ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Kirk Kadelka, who will be followed by Dylan DeThomas. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to thank the author for introducing this bill and moving it through the legislative process. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency supports the bill and the provisions within it. While Minnesota is a leader in waste reduction, reuse, recycling, we still have a ways to go to achieve the goals set out by the legislature in the Waste Management Act. The legislation here would provide us with those additional tools to make those goals possible for waste packaging. Collectively, Minnesota has a waste problem of 5.9 million tons per year. Only about 45% of that material is kept out of waste-to-energy facilities or landfills, with the rest going to those disposal options. As a result, there are negative environmental, human health, and economic impacts. An example is Minnesota saves about 4.6 million tons of carbon dioxide each year due to our current waste reduction, recycling, and composting practices, which is approximately the equivalent of 970,000 passenger vehicles. Reducing and reusing and recycling waste reduces greenhouse gases, while throwing them into a landfill only increases them. There's also the lost economic impact, because each year we throw away 1 million tons of recycled materials. The value of those materials is about $143 million worth throwing away. If we were to able to turn those into new businesses or expand current businesses, we'd be able to create over 15,000 jobs. This bill also would reduce the recycling services for the public and local units of government in a few areas. The first is what you and I pay in our curbside recycling. Those costs on the monthly bill will be covered by the PRO as a result of the collection and processing of those packaging materials. Cities would see their costs reduced. An example is in Virginia, Minnesota. This month they had to reduce and eliminate their curbside collection of recyclable materials because it was costing them over $400,000 a year. Those costs would be covered by the producers under this bill. In addition, a large amount of solid waste activities falls upon the counties. As we look at the SCORE reports, nearly $31 million a year is spent on recycling alone, but we don't have an exact breakdown of what that is for the packaging material. A vast majority of that is spent in this area, which would then be covered by the producer responsibility group instead of the counties. The experiences in Canada and Europe have also showed there's no charge then on consumer prices in return. While we have strong local markets here for recycled materials, they have seen some reduced and closed services over the years, such as West Rock and Goodall. Local markets are the lifeblood of any recycling program, and those that are more stable provide lower prices overall. The bill would also help invest in those local markets for local jobs to use those recycled materials. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Dylan DeThomas, who will be followed by Mike Martin. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, and thank you to Rep. Jordan for your leadership on this critical issue. For the record, my name is Dylan DeThomas, and I represent the Recycling Partnership, and I'm testifying in support of House Files 3577. I lead state policy work for the Recycling Partnership. We're a national nonprofit that collaborates with communities, policymakers, and more than 80 companies to invest in and strengthen public recycling programs across the country. We work with those companies, big brands and manufacturers of packaging materials of all types, glass, aluminum, plastic, and paper products, to insist and assist them to uphold their sustainability goals to serve people on the planet. Those goals include minimum content levels, packaging recyclability goals, and climate goals. The circular economy cannot be achieved by recycling alone, but it can't be done without recycling. We also know that systemic change cannot happen without smart, well-designed policy. We've identified that well-designed EPR, like this bill, that strengthens quality recycling is a critical ingredient to achieving a circular economy in Minnesota and beyond. Our research shows that Minnesota's residential recycling rate, so the single family and multifamily homes that we all live in, is just 20%. EPR for Minnesota could deliver recycling rates for that sector of more than 65%. reinjecting $20 million in lost material value, creating hundreds of jobs across the state, and rescuing those materials from being buried or burned in an incinerator. Some have mistakenly argued that EPR will increase costs to consumers. We have looked in every major market around the world where producer responsibility laws have been implemented. We have not found any credible evidence that compliance fees have affected consumer prices. I'd like to say that again. With well-designed EPR, there is no credible evidence or link between fees and how much consumers pay for products. This is a solid bill, which has been the result of a multi-year and broad, robust stakeholder engagement process, and it should be moved forward, where we hope to see it continue to address outstanding concerns and improve. Thank you for including me in today's hearing.
Thank you. Next, we have Mike Martin, who will be followed by Tony Quillis. Welcome to the committee. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Hi, my name is Michael Martin, and I am the founder and CEO of R Period World. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to speak in support of the Packaging Waste and Cost Reduction Act, House File 3577. I'm here to tell you that reuse works today. Minnesota-based Our World is building the national infrastructure and movement for the reuse economy. We provide a turnkey solution where we provide logistics and washing to solve for reuse. We are operating in 7 states and 44 cities in the United States and are starting to operate in Minnesota this year. The hottest topic in the waste space is reuse, and it is being led out of Minnesota by Our World. When we started the reuse movement back in 2017, we were the first reuse company in the country. There are now dozens of other reuse companies operating all across the country and hundreds around the world. We all know the reduce, reuse, recycle saying. Well, it's an order of priority. We need to move towards reuse. Reuse is cost effective, it builds communities, it creates jobs, and it's better for the environment. We've stopped over 60 tons of plastic from ever being produced and have washed and reused over 7 million items that without our reuse infrastructure would have gone to landfills, incinerators, or the environment. I want to be clear, the issue is not just talking about tackling single-use plastics, it's about single-use everything. I used to be an investment banker on Wall Street, so I know what I'm talking about. It makes no sense that businesses do not factor the disposal cost of their single-use packaging into their P&L. Instead, corporations externalize this cost and make taxpayers subsidize their profits by having Minnesota citizens pay for the disposal of corporation single-use packaging. This is wrong. EPR legislation that supports reuse starts to address this injustice. I ask you to support this bill because we all must be responsible for our own waste. With that, I'd like to thank Representative Jordan, the chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tony Quillis, who will be followed by Peter Glessing. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of brief comments on House File 3577. As you've heard here this afternoon, Minnesota is a national leader in recycling throughout the nation, and we have a robust recycling infrastructure here in Minnesota. But we're unique and different from other states that do recycling because we have a solid waste tax here in Minnesota that we pay as individuals, which is 9.75%, and then 17% on commercial and industrial facilities in the state. And that tax raises a little bit over $100 million a year, about $102 million. This legislature is, through their capital investment and bonding bills, has invested millions of dollars to expand local recycling and composting infrastructure throughout the state of Minnesota. And that doesn't count millions of dollars of private investment to go through and work on these local recycling and composting grants. So the structure's in place, it's there, and it's obviously well-funded. I also like to point out that last year the legislature appointed $600,000 to the Pollution Control Agency to go and do a resource management study to look at solid waste and an overview of our current system, look at ways that we could possibly reduce waste by 90% by 2045, and then report back to the legislature by July 15th of 2025 to look at ways we can improve our recycling system here in Minnesota. In regards to the bill itself, the A2 amendment, which I thank Representative Jordan for, took care of some of the issues that I had, but there aren't complete exemptions for some of the products whose packaging are required by federal law. So think medical, pharmaceuticals, and food. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think there's a good conversation to be had about how we can make our current system better, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Peter Glessing, who will be followed by Rick Horton. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Please proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Peter Glessing, and I'm the Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for Medical Alley. Medical Alley represents a global network of more than 800 leading health technology and care companies in all corners of the state. Our mission is to activate and amplify healthcare transformation. With access, affordability, and quality as top priorities, Medical Alley and our partners are committed to developing solutions which drive meaningful change and save lives. It is with these guiding principles that we express concern about House File 3577's impact on access to care from medical devices, medical drugs, medical equipment, and medical products. Packaging is highly regulated and subject to FDA validation and requirements. Medical device and drug manufacturers are obligated to create packaging according to certain specifications to maintain safety and functionality of life-saving medical devices and medical products used in thousands of routine and complex healthcare procedures every day. This is to ensure that products are safe and effective for patients and consumers. Packaging for devices may not meet these proposed state standards because of the need for certain surface coatings and gas permeability. Packaging specifications and materials are part of the regulatory submission process. Should the state mandate these packaging requirements on medical device packaging, that would subvert the approved use as found in the FDA approval, create a compliance risk with the FDA, and potentially a patient safety issue if sterilization were compromised. Many medical device manufacturers have sustainability goals and support recycling programs for their products and packaging. Some even operate stewardship and partnership programs to reclaim materials, including products and packaging, from consumers and hospitals to divert material from the waste stream and support the circular economy. Medical Alley appreciates Representative Jordan's ongoing consideration of our concerns and the inclusion of the infant formula, medical food, and fortified nutritional supplements in today's amendment. We ask that committee members ensure this legislation prioritizes access to life-saving medical care without risking compliance with the FDA, adding cost to manufacturers, providers, payers, and patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Rick Horton, who will be followed by Amber Backus. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Chair Stevenson and committee members, my name is Rick Horton. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. Together, my industry transforms trees into paper products that we use every single day. MFI is opposed to House File 3577, the EPR bill, as it pertains to forest products and paper products. Available data clearly demonstrates that paper and cardboard recycling rates in Minnesota are above the targets in this bill. The American Pulp and Paper Association shows that nationwide 67.9% of all paper is recycled and 93.6% of cardboard was recycled in 2022. If you look in your packets, you'll find this chart. This is from the 50 States of Recycling report from last December, sponsored by Ball. And if you look at about 4 o'clock on the chart, there's a gray bar, shows that 78% of cardboard, boxboard, and paper is recycled in Minnesota right now. So this is a direct result of our commitment of our industry to recycling. Fiber is important to us, and recycled fiber is a lot cheaper than raw fiber. But paper is made from renewable and sustainably sourced wood. Managing forests actually improves forest health, creates wildlife habitat, reduces wildfire risk, and creates good-paying jobs in impoverished rural communities. We should be encouraging conversion to paper-based packaging rather than forcing punitive regulations upon the industry that's been doing the right thing all along. So given this, we ask that you consider an exemption that removes all references to paper products from the bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is Amber Backus, who will be followed by Mike Morose. Please come forward, state to your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Commerce Committee and Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm Amber Backus with United Strategies here on behalf of the National Waste and Recycling Association's Minnesota chapter and the member companies that have generated over 17,000 jobs and provide collection, sorting, recycling, and disposal of waste in Minnesota. NWRA member companies have been an integral part of making Minnesota's recycling system work, and as you've heard, the state consistently ranks as one of the top in the country. But the bill before you today pushes those companies to the sidelines. It empowers brand manufacturers through the Producer Responsibility Organizations, or PROs, to call the shots. Based on the engrossment before you today, the new brand owner-run PROS will set rates for the work NWRA members do, reducing their margins and ability to increase investment in facility upgrades that allow them to recycle even more material, disrupt, and in some cases eliminate existing contracts between NWRA members and current customers, and reduce competition in the marketplace by creating service territories that may force out small haulers. I know members of this committee are interested in consumer protection reforms to counter monopolies. This bill creates a new system that runs counter to those efforts and encourages consolidation in the recycling industry. In fact, Section 18 of the bill explicitly authorizes the PRO to engage in anti-competitive conduct by making it, quote, immune from liability under state laws relating to antitrust, restraint of trade, and unfair trade practices when implementing collection and recycling systems. Needless to say, this gives our members great heartburn. The NWRA members companies in Minnesota want assurances that their existing customer relationships, operations, and assets will be protected. They want to be able to compete for new business and opportunities, not have the PRO fence them out. And we're appreciative of Representative Jordan and the proponents of the bill in trying to address our concerns, but amendments to date focus on protecting local governments and contracts, not contracts NWRA members have with local governments, individual households, or between one another. In fact, today's A2 amendment has language that clouds things further. Page 814 to 818 of A2 has new language allowing political subdivisions to contract with the PRO, regardless of whether they have existing contracts with waste haulers. This would seem to violate Article 1, Section 11 of the state constitution, which prohibits the state from passing laws that impair the obligations of contracts. Based on a hallway conversation with the bill's proponents, I don't think this was their intent, but having one-off amendments that address only one part of the recycling system and create inconsistencies across the rest adds to the unease of NWRA members who have been building their businesses for years and in some instances multiple generations. And I'd like for you to hear from one of those companies now. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Our next testifier is Mike Morose, who will be followed by Julie Ketchum. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. My name is Mike Morose, and I'm the president and CEO of Walters Recycling and Refuse, headquartered in Blaine. We're a family-owned business, and we'll be celebrating our 36th anniversary here coming up in March. We have an outstanding team of 160 serving the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area, all of whom are dedicated to keeping our communities cleaner and better places to live. While the merits of EPR overall are certainly there with the idea that brands should have a financial stake in reducing the waste that they create and sell, it's hard to argue that. The proposed bill as written is just simply too full of holes, and the unintended consequences of passing it as is, we believe, is a major threat to our business. The bill creates too much uncertainty, especially as it relates to the power and influence of the PRO. As written, the bill will enable the brand owners to pick winners and losers with both our existing open market, where we have business relationships directly with consumers, as well as service agreements we have with various municipalities throughout the area. Our question is, why should these brand owners who don't understand the complexities of our industry, just like we don't understand the complexities of theirs, get to determine how our businesses run and who we get to do business with? And even at what price? How do they understand our economics? The answer is that they don't. Yet they'll be empowered to tell us who we can do business with and at what price, and even dictate when we will be able to get paid for the services that we perform. Unless the bill gets either tabled or enhanced to include solving for these uncertainties, we strongly believe that this bill will put the business that we've spent over 35 years building in jeopardy and also reduce competition in the marketplace for all consumers. There are some who are saying that the additional costs required to manage this new bureaucracy will simply be absorbed by the brands. There's estimates out there that are saying that this is approximately $500 million a year in the state of Minnesota alone. I can tell you, as a business leader for the past 40 years in various small and large corporations, we don't have the margins to absorb significant new costs. The two things that need to happen, either revenues are raised or expenses are cut. And that's how we'd expect the brands to respond to these additional costs. And you're giving them great power to control their costs by dictating what our margins are and how we operate without any recourse. Together with private investments from our industry, as well as working with the PCA and various other public entities, as stated earlier, we've created one of the top recycling states in the country. While we all believe there's room for improvement, turning over the entire recycling industry to brand owners is not the way to leverage everything that we've accomplished and springboard our state to the next level. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Julie Ketchum, who will be followed by Jacob Cassidy. Welcome to the committee. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for WM Waste Management. I've been with the company 22 years, and before that with the MPCA for about 15, so don't add that up. First, I'd like to thank Representative Jordan for meeting with WM and with NWRA and for listening to some of our concerns, but some of the concerns, the major ones, are still not incorporated in the legislation that's before you, especially related to protecting those existing contracts, the contractual relationships with local governments, but also with other companies like Walters Recycling, who you just heard from. WM is the largest recycler in the state of Minnesota. We process nearly 200,000 tons of recyclable material from a five-state region. We were the first company to innovate and bring single-sort recycling to this market, which ultimately increased participation. The idea or the objective was make recycling easier, have everybody put it in one container, sort it out later, and you'll get higher recycling rates, and it worked. It did work. We now have very low residue, lowest in the nation, and it's because we have recycling coordinators that work to get the message out on what exactly is recyclable and what's not. It helps us on our end markets for those materials. Our Twin Cities MRF, our recycling facility over in Minneapolis on Broadway, has been retrofitted four times since it opened in 2001. Yesterday, we announced a further retrofit of that facility that more than doubles our initial investment. It's a multi-million dollar investment. We have been able to innovate, and we've been able to drive the recycling rates higher thanks to the competition that's currently in the market and thanks to the system in which we work under, with the solid waste tax funding some of these recycling contracts. We agree with the previous testimony from Amber Backus of NWRA. We're working lockstep with NWRA. And Mike Moroz is actually a customer of ours. WM provides both recycling collection, and we also process recyclables at our recycling facility. The issue here is I can look Mike in the eye, and I can have a negotiated contract with Mike. He's here locally. Brand owners are not here locally. We are concerned about the power that this legislation gives to brand owners and what they will do to existing contracts. We just simply want to preserve our existing contracts with local governments, and we want to be given preference for expansion into new areas. Let those service providers that are there do the work and let us be compensated. My point is simply this. The current system works. We are able to innovate. We were able to invest in our recycling facility in Minneapolis. Again, we thank the author for her time and attention, and WM just wants to preserve those innovative investments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Our next testifier is Jacob Cassidy, who will be followed by either Ivana Stark or Kyle Rosas. And I'm just going to remind everyone to please stick to 2 minutes so that we can get through all of the people who would like to testify today. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jacob Cassidy. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, or AHAM. AHAM represents over 160 companies that manufacture major portable and floor care appliances. We also represent industry suppliers. I want to take a moment and thank the sponsor for her consideration of our remarks and for taking time last week to meet with me. AHAM remains optimistic that this bill will get into a position that our members would vote to support. We do support all material packaging, so long as certain things are looked at, and I'll refer you to my full remarks instead of taking too much time here. But quickly, one is just look to other states, look to Ontario, Canada for harmonization. If this can be streamlined, much like it sounds like the producer definition was streamlined, that really makes compliance easier as companies are looking already to comply with four different states, which have four different laws. So one of the ways that it can be harmonized is through what they refer to in Ontario as a blue box exemption. The blue box exemption simply is that when an appliance is delivered and the appliance is installed, the packaging for it leaves with the old appliance. As a result, that packaging never enters the residential stream or the blue box. So simply put, that's one way of harmonization that does make streamlining much easier for manufacturers and producers. And other things, as I mentioned, I'll refer you to my testimony, but thank you for your time.
Thank you. Last, we have Vanna Stark or Kyle Ro- it looks like Mr. Rosas. If you come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. I'm Kyle Rosas, Minnesota Deputy Director of Clean Water Action. I want to thank Representative Jordan as well for bringing this up. And our mission as an organization is to protect water quality for future generations. Today I'm speaking on behalf of our 132,000 members in Minnesota regarding the urgent need to find a solution to our waste problem. Producers have become very skilled at transferring responsibility for pollution onto the consumer in an attempt to release themselves from the responsibility for what they create, market, and sell. To achieve a healthier, more sustainable future, we must all work together as producers and consumers. They've marketed a throwaway lifestyle to us, which has in turn filled both foreign and domestic communities with piles of trash they cannot dig out of. Consumers are demanding more sustainable products, we've seen that, and there's an opportunity to reduce our packaging waste at the same time. WestRock, a corrugated packaging company, reports that a recent survey showed more than half of consumers were willing to pay extra for eco-friendly packaging, and that sustainable packaging features impact consumer satisfaction. Sphera, an ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance software company, states that the strongest trends in the packaging industry all revolve around a circular economy, things we've heard today. And encourages clients to strive to meet the EU recycling rate of 75% of packaging waste by 2030. They also encourage reuse, source reduction, and striving to end the use of plastic. Our market is changing, and both consumers and producers recognize that we can't recycle our way out of our waste problem. A more sustainable business model is what consumers are buying into and what our international trade partners are quickly demanding. This bill is a positive step, and I urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Jordan for bringing this bill. We heard a great amount of testimony today talking about the success that Minnesota has had relation to recycling. Wouldn't it be better for us to just make enhancements to our current system rather than upend our current system?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, this is an enhancement to our current system. This bill makes many notices to protecting existing infrastructure and then takes us to that next step. If members are interested in enhancing our current system, this is one solution to doing so.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, to that same point, then, if this was only enhancing our system, wouldn't we be supporting workers by not breaking their contracts and the contracts that exist between the employers and the system? I think that's a key concern, especially when we consider that that this could result in litigation and a dispute that would end up in court.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. There are numerous aspects of this bill that go towards supporting Minnesota workers. There have not been workers that have been laid off as a result of this in other states. There are even parts of this that refer to a living wage and working conditions for workers in Minnesota's recycling.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan. I find that interesting today. I heard it from some of the testifiers to that point. But the fact of the matter was, with my open door this morning, I had union members who traveled 6 hours to be here in opposition to this bill. Union members who are concerned that this bill is frankly going to be an anti-union bill, an anti-union worker bill, because it breaks contracts, but also because of the way that this bill is outlined, will create a system in Minnesota where we aren't using the fine forest resources that we have. And instead, what I'm really concerned about, and I know you are too, Representative Jordan, I'm concerned that we aren't going to be using the natural resources that we have in our forests and our timber products in Minnesota, which could result in more forest fires, and it could result in worse air quality in Minnesota. So I would just kind of ask your consideration to moving in a way where we're looking at this bill, and we don't need to be breaking contracts that exist. If we're already exceeding national standards, or if we're leading the way in the nation, why aren't we looking at sticking with our current contracts when we're already leading the way and not working against Minnesota workers?
Closing comments, Representative Jordan.
Well,
you guys, can't wait until I say closing comments to jump on the list. If you want to talk,
I didn't know if you were going to ask her for a question. I mean,
there was no question in that comment. There's no one on the list. We have a packed agenda today. Please do not do that. If you want to be recognized,
here's our question, but we don't
get on the list and we'll do it. I'm not going to not recognize you, but I'm telling you, I don't wait until I say closing comments. If you know you want to talk, get on the list. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. It was not my intention to surprise you. I just wanted to ask Representative Jordan, I assume based on testimony and based on the exemptions you put into the amendment already that it's just an oversight that medical device packaging was not included and that that will be fixed in a future iteration of the bill.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. For as I told everyone who I met with, including many manufacturers of medical devices, it was important for me to set up this week and work on a process for individuals to be applying with the pro to have that exemption process rather than having me pick and choose. I had a great conversation with Medical Alley and others, and we will be working on that going forward.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. Again, I've said it before, my late husband managed an operating room, and dealing with medical devices and new knees and all kinds of things, obviously, for obvious reasons, there is very specific packaging that we need to take into consideration. I would also just ask, you know, I mean, the bill encourages package redesign and to reduce waste. Isn't there already a financial incentive for companies to design their packaging with minimal waste? I mean, frankly, I suspect a big shipper is going to ensure that their packaging is sufficient so that it doesn't fall apart in transit, but that they're not wasting materials. There is a cost incentive already for them to not waste materials.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a cost incentive to the business, but there is not, the businesses are not responsible for the disposal. And so that is not part of the cost incentive for businesses. And that is what this bill does, is it says, as you are generating this waste, and the more waste you generate, the more responsibility you have to deal with the end of that waste. That needs to be prioritized. And that's what this bill does, is it talks about the incentives to deal with the waste itself, not just getting the package from X facility to your home.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does a lot more than that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Katisa Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing this bill forward. I know that you are a tremendous steward for our environment and a champion for Minnesota workers, so that the conversations and the due diligence that you've put into putting this package together is really appreciated. I'm sure that I'm not the only committee member who has gotten emails from folks in their district about organics recycling fees over the last couple of months. There was, I believe it was a Supreme Court decision about how our recycling law that was actually passed back in 1991 impacts recycling, organics recycling fees. And so folks are, you know, spending extra money on this and And I think that it is time for our distributors to pay their fair share when consumers are being burdened by these sorts of fees and making sure that we're doing the right thing for the environment. So I really appreciate you taking the lead on this.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have any questions, more just some observations and comments this afternoon. It appears to me if you like putting control in the hands of big business to make decisions about the packaging, the style of product, having unique packaging systems that will be applied in Minnesota and not necessarily across the rest of the country, so it's a special one-off when sending things to Minnesota, which will only have a driving price, an effect of driving prices higher than they already are under the hyperinflation environment we found ourselves in the last couple of years. This bill is absolutely for you. Again, if you want to have specialized packaging, you want to have higher prices and limited availability of the distribution of products as manufacturers decide what they will and will not do based on the concept of this law. The quantity of products that you may get in a purchase, the different options that are available, size, style, and things. And if you really want to limit your availability, this is a yes vote for you. If you want to have availability and maybe put more education out there and continue with the things that have been successful, then a no vote is really what you should be looking at in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brief closing comments, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, if you are not satisfied with the way that we are dealing with our waste, a yes vote is a good vote on this bill, and I ask for your support to get it to the State and Local Government Committee. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 3577, as amended, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3577, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Our last item on our agenda today is House File 3578 from Representative Bonner. I am going to move House File 3578 be laid over for further consideration. Members, we have about a half an hour before we have to conclude today. It's going to be my goal to make sure that we prioritize getting all of the testimony in today from the public. So just the motion was to lay over, so we will probably get through the testimony and probably not have time to do much beyond that today.
But it'll come back.
It's being laid over, so it would have to come back for any further action in the committee. Did you have a question?
I was just going to say, I want to make sure that I don't have any errors about getting on the list if we're going to have discussion today.
Yeah, if you want to be on the list, you can get on the list. I was looking at you the whole time during that to make sure, and you didn't do it until I said closing comments. All right, 3578, Representative Bonner, I've made the motion to lay the bill over for further consideration. You have the A5 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape you'd like it to be considered. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will move the A5 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A5 is adopted. Representative Bonner, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members and Mr. Chair. Prior authorization is not new, and I suspect everyone in this room has experienced the frustration of prior authorization. The process is used by insurers and health plans was originally intended to review care that may be expensive, experimental, or may have health and safety concerns before the patient receives care. Health plans argue it ensures care is appropriate and cost-effective. Patients and doctors state it interferes with doctor-patient relationships, their ability to deliver preventative care, creates unnecessary barriers to delay care, leading to adverse patient outcomes and harm, all the while increasing administrative burden and creating significant costs. In 2020, we passed a prior authorization reform bill, considered among the strongest in the nation. The bill focused on process, reduced decision-making times, requiring adverse decisions be made by physicians of the same or similar specialty as the ordering physician, and requiring health plans to publicly post data on the use of prior authorization on their websites to improve transparency. These reforms have proven helpful. However, we have heard from practicing physicians that care requiring prior authorization have skyrocketed, while patients are experiencing significant barriers to care. National data shows that physicians complete about an average of 41 hours of authorizations per week, spending 13 hours a week on approvals, taking physicians and clinicians away from direct patient care. 94% of physicians report delays in care, 80% report patients having abandoned treatment, 33% report serious adverse outcomes, including 19% reporting life-threatening events. It's clear we have not met the intent of the 2020 bill, nor the original goals of prior authorization to deliver better care and increase safety at reduced costs. For these reasons, clarifications are in order. The bill has two main goals. It prohibits the use of prior authorization for preventative and critical services that should not have barriers to care by definition. It requires an annual report to the Commerce Department outlining how often prior auth is used, the approval and denial rates for care. So let's dive just a brief bit deeper. For 20 years, Minnesota law has prohibited prior authorization for emergency services based on widespread agreement that patients should not have barriers to life-saving care. The bill expands this to preventative care and targeted services where barriers to care may lead to severe or life-threatening patient outcomes. These include the use of generic drugs or biosimilars approved by the FDA, services recommended by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, setting best practices to meet the goals of good health, harm reduction, and cost savings, outpatient mental health and substance use disorder treatment, medications to treat substance use disorder, including Suboxone, cancer treatment consistent with the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, such as chemotherapy, radiation, gene therapy, and bone marrow transplants. Lastly, pediatric hospice and treatment for neonatal addiction. Let's be clear. Barriers to care for these services are dangerous, and according to the health plan's own websites, they are generally approved between 80 to 95% of the time, meaning they are nearly always approved. In addition, the bill prohibits the use of authorization prior auth for providers already accepting risk through value-based contracts, and for patients with chronic disease for which treatments rarely change, like diabetes, it prohibits insurers from requiring the patient to seek approval more than once for the same treatment. Because these services are covered, it should not add cost to the insurer. However, it would greatly reduce the cost to physicians, clinics, hospitals, and patients. The second goal requires insurers to create an annual report to the Commerce Department, providing policymakers critical data to make sure it's used appropriately. And it clarifies the intent of the 2020 law to increase public transparency, standardizing data for an apples-to-apples comparison, and ensures posted data on the websites can be easily found. Finally, the bill directs the Commerce Commissioner to use the data to make sure that there are recommendations to the legislature to simplify health insurance prior auth, standards to process and improve healthcare access, reduce delays in care, reduce administrative burden on healthcare providers, and maximize quality. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. First testifier we have on the list is Dr. Laurel Reese. Dr. Reese.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Laurel Reese. I'm a family physician on Rice Street, just north of here in St. Paul. Been there for 18 years. I do go home at night. I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association, and I'm here representing our 10,000 members who are physicians in training and for the Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. You see, death by a thousand cuts used to be a method of torture, but now it's a daily practice with prior authorization. This is our everyday work, and every physician who's in this room can tell you stories of how prior authorization has decreased our efficiency and delayed care for our patients this week. And I'll give you an example of a patient of mine. She ran out of insulin. She's been well controlled. She's been on the same high dose of insulin for a long time. So she called her pharmacy to refill it. They said, oh, you have to get a prior authorization. She ran out that day. So her daughter called me at the clinic and said, you know, my mom needs this medicine. The pharmacy called us too. We sent this to our team of people that we hire specifically to run prior authorization. So our system hires entire groups of people just to do this paperwork. And they said, yep, we'll get to that in 72 hours. Now in 72 hours without her insulin, she'll be dead or in the hospital, one of those two. So she has to get insulin now. So I send it to our pharmacist to see if there are any workarounds. And he's familiar with Minnesota's urgent need program specifically for insulin. So he sent her information to our social worker who called her daughter to do the paperwork to do this. And then the daughter came in, got the paperwork, took it to the pharmacy. She got her insulin filled. I saw her on Monday. She said, I haven't heard back from anybody if that prior authorization was approved yet. So our staff called back, and the prior authorization has been approved for 1 year. And we're going to do this all again next year for this patient. And this is just one person. The average Minnesota physician is doing this 40 times a week. And you can understand why we are here today, because there are some problems we can't fix in the exam room. And this is one of them. This is a major thorn for patients. It's a major thorn for their physicians. So we're seeking to reduce the burden of prior authorization on our patients and our healthcare teams, and to limit prior authorization on things that are just things that we want to get covered routinely. 85 to 95% of requests are ultimately approved, and these are the low-hanging fruit of the things that are we really need to get approved every time. And we think that including things like generic medications, mental health care, substance use disorder, cancer treatment, and increasing transparency can help us to better understand the effects of prior authorization in Minnesota, and we ask for your support for HF 3578. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reese. The next testifier is Maureen Alderman, who will be followed by Nicole Helios. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Maureen Alderman. I'm a patient advocate serving on the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. Professionally, I work in food safety, quality, and regulatory, but more importantly, I'm the mother to two incredible children, Cameron and Caroline. I'm here to speak in support of HF 3578. Testifying on my own behalf. Caroline was born in November 2020, and thanks to the newborn screening, she was discovered to have a very rare health condition just 2 days after birth. Caroline has a condition known as arginosinicillic aciduria, which is the hardest thing I'll say today. We just call it ASA for short, a type of urea cycle disorder. It's a 1 in 70,000 condition. Her body cannot fully digest protein, and instead it creates ammonia, which is lethal to your body. Thankfully, the newborn screening saved her life, and the medical care we've received since has only continued to increase her quality of life. When Caroline was born, we were given a very bleak outlook for her long-term life. What we discovered was that there are specialists for these rare conditions, and by the grace of God, we found a world-renowned specialist right at our own doorstep at the University of Minnesota. Under the care of her team at the U, Caroline's development has far exceeded everything we could have ever imagined. In those early NICU days, we were told Caroline's health would have an immediate impact on her IQ and overall development. This is something that no parent wants to hear about your baby. However, Caroline's incredible doctors, paired with the proper diet and medication, has allowed her to have less frequent doctor visits, less lab draws, and more freedom to have be a healthy, happy, thriving toddler. Caroline will forever be on 3 prescription medications as her condition is chronic. One being a revolutionary drug called Ravicti, which is considered an ammonia scavenger. This medication maintains Caroline's ammonia level if she were ever going to crisis, as they call it, which is really nice to hear about your kid. Ravicti is unfortunately only available at 2 pharmacies in the country, and there's no generic or other medication that can replace it since it's new to the market. Ravicti is very expensive and rare. Our insurance would love to supplement it for something else. So at the end of June, my husband and I have a calendar reminder that goes off on our calendar that says prior auth for Ravicti, because on July 1st, we know we will receive a letter saying that our coverage expires and requires that we go through the extensive prior authorization process again. Now, thankfully, we do have the incredible care team at the U that knows just how to fight this battle and can explain the criticality this medication plays. So there's no delay in Caroline receiving this critical medication. A delay could be devastating to her function, but unfortunately, that is not the case for many, or having this care team is not the case for every rare disease family. There's no margin for error. Any disruption in having a competent care provider can mean delayed access. In the case we don't get the approval, what will happen to our daughter's health? Everywhere we go with Caroline, we carry what is called an emergency letter. Because if her ammonia gets high, it isn't weeks that she could see impacts. It's hours, and doctors have told us it truly could be minutes. So without her medication, instead of playing in her yard with her big brother, she could be in a coma in the hospital. To be honest with you today, this isn't something I usually even let my mind go to. Because no parent should have to think about what you can act if you cannot access a drug you know is saving your child's life. This shouldn't be a question, but it is for so many chronically ill people. The stress endured knowing that the medications exist to keep you or your loved ones healthy, but insurance or paperwork may be keeping you from it, should not be how we operate. So as I sit here, knowing my two healthy, beautiful children can't wait for me to get home so we can go to skating lessons tonight as a family, I hope you'll think of Caroline and all our other the other families dealing with chronic conditions that could be making memories together instead of on the phone with insurance companies or even worse, sitting bedside in the hospital together. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with the committee. Our next testifier is Nicole Hilias, who will be followed by Dan Andreessen. As a reminder, we need everyone to try and keep it 2 minutes here. Ms. Hilias.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Nicole Hilias, and I'm the manager of prior authorization at Children's Minnesota. I appreciate you having me here today to express our support for House File 3578, which makes changes to prior authorization requirements that would allow us to better serve our patients and families. Children's Minnesota is the state's largest pediatric health care system, seeing more than 160,000 kids annually. In 2023, the 30 members of our prior authorization team worked to complete over 81,000 requests for nearly 58,000 individual people. Many of these children are suffering from life-threatening diseases that need prior authorization or PA approvals before receiving treatment. Our prior authorization team has almost tripled in size over the last 3 years to accommodate the reality that authorizations have become more frequent and more complex. When a patient comes to us and it is determined a medication or a specific service needs, they need to have a specific treatment, we first determine if a PA is needed. Once the need is established and a request is submitted, treatment for that patient can be delayed anywhere from 48 hours to 14 business days, depending on the insurance provider. Note that this timeline only applies to requests initially approved without any additional complications. In other cases, when the initial request is denied by the insurer, the process of appealing the denial can take months. Today, I want to share the impact this has had on one of our patient families. James, whose name has been changed to protect our patient's privacy, is an 11-year-old who was diagnosed with leukemia and is insured through Medicaid. 3 months ago, my team submitted a PA request for a drug to treat James's cancer and learned that it was denied because the drug we requested, though it is the standard of care for his illness, was not the preferred drug for Medicaid. Medicaid instead recommended we try two other drugs not approved for a patient James's age before using the drug they denied. My team and James's care team are still working to appeal this denial on behalf of James's family. In the meantime, James is being treated with the drug that we requested prior authorization for. Just two doses of this drug cost $79,000, and the family still doesn't know if it's going to be covered. This story is not unique. In another case, a request for a liquid form of medication for a patient with a cardiovascular condition was denied and a tablet was suggested. The patient was 2 months old. A tablet could not be dosed or administered appropriately for a child of that age and size. Getting PA approvals for liquid medications that can be appropriately dosed for young children has also been a challenge for patients in hospice or those experiencing neonatal withdrawal. After going back and forth with denials and appeals on these cases, over 95% of these requests do get approved.
I'm going to need you to wrap up your testimony now.
Thank you. But too often, the time it takes to complete the process leaves families to make a difficult decision to move forward with their child's treatment without knowing if it will be covered by their insurance. This is not what a family should have to worry about while their child is fighting a life-threatening illness. We can do better for the children and families living in our state. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for your leadership on this bill, and thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you. Next is Dan Andreessen, who will be followed by Bentley Graves. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the Trade Association for Minnesota's nonprofit insurers, which includes Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford Health, and UCare. The stories that you've heard today, well, our members want the process to work as efficiently as possible. And if the stories today you've heard involve one of the council member health plans, then we want to find solutions to that. Patients should not be put in the middle of this process. However, the council is opposed to broadly eliminating the use of PA as a way to solve these situations. PA is a real-time check on healthcare services to address potentialities of patient harm, but also making sure that we're driving people to the lowest cost services so they're not overpaying for their care. Council health plans try to be targeted with its use of PA, and it's not used for all healthcare services. Of the total number of claims our plans process, over 98% of those claims never see a PA. PA is focused on services and treatments which have a potential to cause significant harm, have a high cost, or have various alternatives, or they're services that plans have seen a track record of inappropriate care or fraudulent use. So if you're a provider who cares for patients and prescribes these type of services and treatments, you may be submitting more PAs than your peers because of the area of medicine that you're practicing. But we know providers have concerns over PAs, and that's why in 2020 we negotiated with them on a bill to put new regulations on PA as well as establish timelines for PAs when they need to be complete. State law requires that all PAs must be done within 5 business days. If the provider requests an expedited review of that case, it has to be done within 48 hours. Now, it's important to note that that law only applied to the fully insured commercial market. Unfortunately, the proponents of the bill at that time exempted Medicaid and Minnesota Care from those requirements, and it doesn't apply to the employer-sponsored plans because of the ERISA federal presumption. So if there's concerns about delays of care, we're wondering if this is showing up in markets that are not being covered by this 2020 law. We do have several questions about the bill, but two things I just want to point out about the bill. The exemptions in there, we don't think that they're really considering the future changes in medical practices or new treatments and the costs associated with these changes. And obesity is kind of a good example where things have changed quite a bit with the last year. So we think that we need to make sure that we're addressing that, as well as new federal guidance that just came down a month ago regarding PA that's going to be impacting the market.
Thank you. Thank you. Next testifier is Bentley Graves, who will be followed by Michelle Crimmins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We have been involved in these conversations around prior auth for many years, including back to 2020. And through that, we've always looked to maintain prior auth and its usefulness in ensuring quality and safety, but also as a mechanism for cost control. But as you've heard today, you know, there are remaining concerns about delay, about administrative costs, and about frustration in the system that bring us to this conversation today. And through this, again, we want to make sure that we maintain prior auth in its usefulness, but also look for opportunities to bring in line with today's technology in our healthcare ecosystem. And we're pleased that we believe there are pieces of this bill that will do that. First and foremost, automatic prior auth, we think, would address many of the concerns that have been brought forward and continue to drag down this conversation and flag frustration in the system. The other is the portion of the bill that directs attention to the potential for value-based purchasing to address issues with prior authorization as well. I don't know that the language that's in the bill gets that quite right to this point, but we do think that this is an opportunity for all of us to ask the question of how we can take advantage of this situation to lean into value-based purchasing as a means not just to solve problems here with prior auth, but also to address other issues in our healthcare ecosystem, not the least of which is cost. We are pleased to see that the amendment kind of pulled back the effort to exempt a number of providers and ask the department instead to look at that along with the data being submitted to come up with a recommendation about whether or not that would be workable and how that would be workable. And we would suggest that maybe the same be done with the effort in the bill to exempt a number of services as well. And finally, I just want to say we are pleased that this would apply these requirements equally to both the commercial market and public programs. We have very, very few means of which to gauge the cost of such moves on the commercial market, but this, through the fiscal lending process, may give us some sense of what those cost implications are, and we're looking forward to see what that looks like. It will better inform our conversation and engagement going forward. But thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Michelle Crimmins, who will be followed by Margaret Reynolds. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Crimmins. I am a registered lobbyist representing Prime Therapeutics, a pharmacy benefit manager headquartered in Eagan, Minnesota. Prior authorization used for the health benefit and the drug benefit are very different. For example, a knee replacement surgery is performed once. A drug to treat a chronic illness is taken for life and requires ongoing monitoring. Because of these differences, it's important to note that my testimony today solely discusses the impact of HF 3578 on the use of prior authorization for prescription drugs. Prior authorization requirements are set on prescription drugs that should only be used for certain health conditions that have dangerous side effects, are harmful when combined with other drugs, may be misused or abused, or if there are equally effective drugs available at a more affordable cost. For example, money drugs to treat breast cancer require genetic testing to confirm that the prescribed therapy will benefit the patient. In that instance, a prior authorization would ensure that the genetic testing was completed and the drug will be of benefit. This isn't the first time we've discussed the value of prior authorization programs. In 2010, Minnesota passed a new law requiring the use of electronic prior authorization, often referred to as EPA. The EPA process is in real time and when utilized will not delay a patient from receiving a prescription that is covered for their condition. This law was a great first step in improving the prior authorization process, but prescribers have not reached 100% adherence with the law. Additionally, in 2020, Minnesota passed SF3204 into law, and this bill set a reasonable requirements for the use of prior authorization, such as annual posting of prior authorization data on a plan's website, a limit on prior authorization data request requirements, required health plan change notifications, a requirement for any adverse determination to be made by a licensed physician in the same area of practice as the prescribing physician, and many more. Section 12 of HF 3578 asks the commissioner to issue a report analyzing the use of prior authorization in healthcare. The report is to analyze the effect of utilization management tools on patient access, administrative burden, and system costs.
And I'm going to need you to wrap up your testimony now.
We thank the bill author for removing Section 9, but to continue to have concerns that the remaining bill language has the unintended consequence of impacting the value bought by prior authorization programs. For these reasons, we oppose HF 3578. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Margaret Reynolds, who will be followed by Michelle Mack. Let's come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Margaret Reynolds. I'm with Cigna. My prior authorization serves the purpose of ensuring a patient receives medically appropriate care under their medical and pharmacy benefits. These are two distinct benefits, as Ms. Crimmins mentioned. Specific to prescription drugs, I have concerns with Section 7, the definition of chronic health condition in the bill. A patient would have a prescription that never expires once an initial prior authorization is obtained, unless the standard for treatment changes. This is not patient-centered, and it does not consider changes the patient may have in their disease state or lifestyle changes they may make to manage their condition. Switching to the medical benefit, it is a very different process, and I'll just highlight concerns. I can send these to you in writing as well. Section 3, adverse determination, the addition of Clause 2 does not allow for utilization review organization to redirect care, as it would count as a denial. An example, so young children with headaches, many providers start with a CT scan, which is a less expensive test than an MRI. However, the evidence-based guidelines indicate that an MRI is the better option because of the quality of the image produced. The prior authorization would allow the provider to go directly to the MRI, helping the patient avoid potentially harmful delays in diagnosis and the copay associated with an extra test. The definition of adverse determination should be worked on because it's part of the automated process language in Section 5, Clause 4, and part of the report required in Section 11. Section 4, we are wondering what the rationale is for removing the electronic prior authorization, as mentioned, with the prescription. It should be nearly instantaneous if providers are abiding by that. So we have concerns with removing that language. Section 5, language could use further refinement to ensure compliance with the latest CMS rules. As previous testifiers have mentioned, Section 6, we have numerous concerns with how the services and pharmacy are commingled in there. Happy to work with you on that. Section 8, downside risk financial arrangements are not a proxy for consistent application of evidence-based care. I think we should reevaluate the inclusion of that in this bill. Section 11, the annual report or utilization management data is proprietary. We'd like to work on that language and work on it in the aggregate. And Section 12, the removal of pattern. A single determination could count against a physician performing the utilization review. Did I do 2 minutes?
Just over, but we'll call it there. Thank you. All right, our next testifier is Michelle Mack, who will be followed by Michelle Benson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Stevenson and members of the committee. I apologize for my throat here. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, also known as PCMA. PCMA represents America's Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs. PCMA has concerns with House File 3578 as drafted, and while we are thankful to the author for removing Section 9, at this time we respectfully are opposed. PBMs are engaged by a client to manage pharmacy benefits pursuant to health insurance benefits and contracts. PBMs only manage pharmacy benefits that occur in the prescription drug benefit. The testifiers before me have provided you information on what prior authorization is and why our clients, that include insurers, use it with the primary goals of, one, to ensure that appropriateness and suitability of the prescribed medication for the specific patient, two, safety, and three, to control costs. The bill as drafted puts all prior authorizations into the same bucket, when in reality there is a difference between medical and prescription. For example, in Section 1, Subdivisions 1 and 2, a prescription drug prior authorization under the prescription drug benefit is never retrospectively denied, nor would it be denied if this service has already been received. This is because once a prior authorization is approved for a prescription drug, the patient receives said prescription drug for the amount of time approved. Also, a prescription drug is not a service. We also have issues with relative to Section 5, which my colleague Margaret Reynolds talked about relative to the automated process. In addition, we have concerns with Section 6 as it's changing the emergency exemptions to certain exemptions. This includes not being able to use prior authorization for generic drugs, interchangeable biosimilars, and medications to treat substance use disorders. Just because a drug has one of these designations does not mean it will not have a dangerous side effect, is not harmful when combined with other drugs, or cannot be misused or abused. Finally, we have concerns with Section 7, which, as a previous testifier stated, deals with prior authorizations for chronic conditions. As written, this is very broad and an encompassing requirement. I appreciate the committee's time and attention to our concerns, and we're willing to continue to have conversations with the bill proponents and author. Thank you for your time, and I am available for questions.
Thank you.
Our last testifier is Michelle Benson. Welcome to the committee. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members and representative. I'm Michelle Benson with the Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota, representing Allina Health, Aetna, Cigna, and United Healthcare. As members know, COVID changed healthcare in this country in many ways. Health plans, learning lessons from COVID, are incorporating those changes going forward, including the way they conduct prior authorization. Additionally, CMS is promulgating new rules around the interoperability of electronic health information, including prior authorization. In this dynamic environment, policymakers should consider alignment with emerging federal standards, thus limiting the cost and complexity of a patchwork approach here in Minnesota. During testimony today, a testifier indicated that their coverage was through medical assistance. We thank the author for recognizing the need to include public programs and the preferred drug list to ensure that the same standards held for the fully insured market apply to our public programs. The 2020 bill did not hold to this standard, and we appreciate the change. As the committee and representative consider the structure of the reports to be included in this bill, the data should be shown in aggregate, or at the very least, de-identified. Additionally, it may be helpful for the public and policymakers for information to be available by coverage type, public program, ERISA, the fully insured market, etc. There should also be an opportunity to compare the effectiveness of electronic prescribing on prior authorization and paper prescribing on prior authorization. Members, we appreciate your attention to this important matter focused on patient care, value, and service to the people we care about here in Minnesota. Thank you, Representative, for your work, for listening. Good day.
Thank you. All right, that's all the time we have for today. We're going to lay the bill over until we get a fiscal note. So the bill is laid over and the meeting is adjourned.